In the European Union, the movement of workers has been super controversial. Workers in richer countries have been worried that allowing migration from poorer countries would hurt their way of life. The concern over migrants arose first from Portugal and Spain in the 1980s and 1990s, and then from Eastern Europe in the 2000s. In France, this turned into a huge political problem.
Il était une fois un plombier polonais.
Once upon a time, there was a Polish plumber.
Le dumping social des employés de l'Est de l'Europe qui viennent travailler en France ou en Allemagne pour moins cher que les salariés locaux. Bonjour Nicolas Barré.
The concern was whether EU rules would allow a Polish plumber to work in France for cheaper than a French plumber. At the same time, the EU's freedom of worker movement was one of the foundational pillars of the European integration project. Policymakers in poorer European countries like Poland saw the movement of workers as one potential way to help their countries catch up. But what are the policies that guide the movement of workers across Europe? When workers move, what labor regulations are they subject to? What are the impacts of these policies and regulations on workers in a host country like France? On the flip side, what are the impacts on that posted worker's old community back home? This episode examines European workers under one super interesting framework, the EU's posting policy. To tackle all this, I will be joined by a very special guest.
Mathilde Munoz, UC Berkeley.
Mathilde Munoz is an economics professor at the University of California, Berkeley. She's an expert on trade, workers, and labor standards. Mathilde is European, she's French, and she's going to share results from some of her brand new research into the impact of the EU posting policy on European workers. Hi, Mathilde.
Hi, Chad.
You are listening to an episode of Trade Talks, a podcast about the economics of trade and policy. I'm your host, Chad Bown, the Reginald Jones Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Mathilde, to start, introduce us to the history and thinking behind this European integration project. Where did the European Union come from?
The European Union, or the idea of the European Union, is actually an old one. I think the first person to actually talk about Europe as a United States of Europe was Victor Hugo in 1850. And so what he said is actually very interesting. He said, one day will come where the only fields of battle will be markets opening to trade, which I think is an amazing kind of insight of what European Union will become. And so indeed, when the construction of this United States of Europe really started was after the war. So after 1945, after years and years of battles and conflicts, there were this idea that the only way to go forward was really to try to build this unified federal union that was going to, in a way, solve those issues that led to the wars. And so the way it worked in practice was that in the 50s and 90s, 57, to be precise, the core old member state decided to sign the Treaty of Rome, and so they committed to the four economic freedom. So what we call economic freedom in Europe are the free movement of goods, services, people, and capital. Those are the four pillars of European integration that were meant to allow this construction of United States of Europe.
After the initial members signed the Treaty of Rome and committed to this path of European integration, how did they implement it in practice?
Those member states signed the treaty, and then the implementation of the treaty worked, I would say, in three main steps. In the first decade, a member state worked on removing all obvious barriers to integration. So they decreased tariffs and they've signed all those agreements to make trade free in a way, the way we would think about it when we think about trade policy in the world. The second step really happened because we realized that the first step was not enough. Even if you decrease tariffs and you don't have formal borders, you realize there are many other ways that can prevent trade or prevent integrations. One famous example was that Italy required pasta production to have 100% durum semola to, make pasta. And so those were what we call today non-tariff trade barriers. But member states were really aware that we needed to go one step further if we wanted to build that United States of Europe in this united market. And so what they did was to implement what's called the Single Market Act. So the Single Market Act or the single market approach is really to have one single standard and not have this kind of national idiosyncratic barriers to trade. And biggest step and almost the most politically controversial, which was the political union. So what do we do to be a political union? And so when the Maastricht Treaty was introduced in the mid-90s, that was the time when European member state agreed to have a central bank, to have institutions that were meant to oversee this United States of Europe. And that's the last step that led to the European Union the way we know it today.
How far had economic integration gone as of the 1990s? When you look at those four freedoms at that stage, where was Europe integrated and where was it not integrated?
I think the consensus in the 90s was that the trade policy for goods was pretty successful following this single European Act, the end of tariffs. And what we could see is that European countries were trading a lot within Europe after the end of those tariffs. At that point, we were seeing a lot of integration in terms of trading goods, but perhaps not the level of migration or service trade or capital flows that would be consistent with the differences in, let's say, GDP per capita or wages. So obviously there were some huge migration waves from Spain to France or from Spain to Germany. But we think that the level of those migration flows were maybe not big enough if you relate that to the differences in terms of growth or economic well-being or wages across European member states at the time. If you think about it, Spain or Italy was still much poorer compared to France, the UK or Germany, even accounting for the level of prices. So there were still a lot of dispersion in the way those countries were doing economically and even socially.
Europe was making progress, but it was far from completely integrated economically by the 1990s. At the same time, you have the fall of the Berlin Wall, then the breakup of the Soviet Union, and end of the Cold War. What happened next in Europe?
So obviously, when the Berlin Wall fell and it was the end of the Soviet Union, this meant a huge change in the geography of the world, but also of the European Union. So there were really this open question of what would happen to all those countries in Eastern Europe that were leaving or gaining their independence from Russia and the Soviet Union? And oh, are we going as this United States of Europe going to integrate those countries and make them part of our project? Because it was always, I think, in the mind and in the philosophy that those countries were part of this project just because of the geography and the history of the European Union. And so this meant that in the 90s, all European countries also had to think forward and had to think about how to integrate this massive number of people, very different countries that had a very different history to that project, and how are we going to handle this trade liberalization, but also the potential migration flows and changes in the geography of the European Union. And so what happened when those Eastern European countries became part of the European Union is that we started to see a huge take-up of this existing policy that was called the posting policy.
What is the EU's posting policy? How does the posting policy work? Maybe start with an example.
The posting policy just means that if you are a construction firm located in Poland, you are allowed to sell your services or to export your services in order to serve, let's say, French customers. And in order to do that, obviously, your business is to build houses or to do plumbing services. So what you need to do is to have your own employees go temporarily to France to build that house for the French customer and then come back to your country. Instead of having to open a shop in France and to hire maybe workers or French workers there and to build a house and then to come back to Poland, what the posting policy really does is to allow you to export as any other firm, but because of the type of activity you do, you just need to send your own employees abroad. That's really the spirit of this policy.
Was this EU posting policy some new policy designed for the Eastern European countries just joining the EU?
So this policy was not new. It was actually established in the 1960s. And why was it there? Just because one of the four economic freedom was to ensure freedom to supply services. And so European countries had to decide how to handle freedom to supply services when services need to be supplied next to customers. And so it was always there. And it was very little in terms of numbers. And all of a sudden, after the accession of Eastern European countries, the number of posted workers really started to skyrocket in the EU. So we started to see a lot of firms and workers using this policy in order to move and to work in the EU.
You gave us the example of a Polish construction firm sending its workers to build houses in France. How does the EU's posting policy work in practice? What labor regulations does the Polish firm operating in France have to follow?
What is difficult with this policy is that it is a joint trade and migration policy. And so all of a sudden, member states had to think about labor market regulation. So if you think about it, when a firm, let's say, sells a washing machine from Poland to France, we don't really care about what this firm is doing in terms of labor standard. We just buy this washing machine. All of a sudden, you have this Polish plumber coming to France and working in France under a Polish employment contract. And so this meant that the European countries had to take a stance at which of the French or Polish labor code is going to apply to that weird posting assignment. And so the philosophy in the EU, the decision that was taken was that social security contributions, so payroll taxes, for instance, were always going to be set by the exporting country. So in my example, Poland. So the worker pay payroll taxes in Poland. But during the contract performed in France, France has the right to impose its French minimum wage to the Polish workers. It's the only time in the EU where one country is actually allowed to impose its domestic standards to foreign firms. It's the only exception to the free trade kind of spirit in the European Union.
Was this exception part of the original posting policy of the 1960s?
And this was a change because actually at the very beginning, because we had this idea that free trade should be the same for the construction firm or for the firm building or producing washing machine, there were no idea that those importing countries were allowed to impose their standards. It all changed in 1996 because following the accession of Portugal, Portugal was very poor when it was accepted as a member state in the EU, rich member states started to worry. And so they established this kind of institutional framework to be allowed to protect themselves against competition from countries with lower labor regulations. And so even though there were a lot of changes in the institutions about this posting policy, and despite the fact that everyone was aware that there was a jump in the use of this posting policy, we didn't know a lot about it, actually. There were very little numbers. It was a huge political debate, but never kind of grounded in numbers. And so that's what got me interested in it.
Now I want to turn to your research. One really big contribution of your project is very non-glamorous. You just built amazing data sets. You said the debate wasn't grounded in numbers. Well, that was partly because there were no numbers. You managed to create the data to provide numbers to explain the importance of this policy. Okay, to start, tell us about the sectors using the EU posting policy. You gave us the example of the Polish construction firm. In the overall data, is that example typical?
So the representative posted worker, you know, the average posted worker in the EU is not necessarily a plumber, but it does work in the construction industry. So the first sector using this policy is construction, following by manufacturing. So this is going to be manufacturing services, let's say temporary employment agency workers going to come to your factory to help you to produce stuff. Then you're going to have a lot of posted workers in road transportation. So international drivers tend to be posted workers. And then the other important sectors are agricultural workers, so temporary seasonal workers who come to a country in order to pick fruit or to help to produce wine, and then cleaners.
Those are the industries. What do we know about these posted workers being employed by these exporting firms and sent from one country to work in another? How do those workers compare to migrants?
So what is interesting is that those posted workers are actually a bit different if you look at them, even compared to migrants who come from the same country. So the migrant who is going to move from Poland to France is not the same that the posted worker who is going to be sent from Poland to France. So one first big difference is gender. So posted workers are almost all men. 95% of posted workers are men, while migrants tend to be 50-50. And the reason is probably that the type of jobs that are required for posting tend to be male-dominated jobs, so in construction or in manufacturing services. And obviously, we could have thought that some other jobs that also need to be close to customers, let's say nurses, for instance, would have been affected a lot by the posting policy, but it didn't really happen, and we don't really know why. One potential answer is that there's still a lot of non-tariff kind of barriers in health jobs that may prevent women to move. Another obvious kind of elephant in the room is also someone needs to stay home to take care of the kids. And so you also have this gender discrepancy in the way posting can work.
How else are posted workers different from migrants?
Another interesting difference to me is also the level of education and age. So in Europe, migrants tend to have higher level of education compared to their counterparts who do not move in the origin country, but also sometimes compared to the natives in the destination country. I'm obviously talking about European migrants here, to be clear. And so that's not the case for posted workers, because more than 70% of posted workers have blue-collar jobs that do not require a college education. So those workers have not the same level of education compared to migrants. And in a sense, that's logical, right? Because you think that in order to move from one country to another, maybe you need some liquidity, maybe you need some money, maybe you need to gather some information. And this is going to be very hard to do if you're just a plumber in Poland. You need to save, you need to know what is going to be the job opportunity in France. While maybe if you are a consultant or something like that, it's going to be much easier to shop around for a job. The age difference to me is also very striking, because some migrants at the time when they move, European migrants tend to be around 25, according to the data we have. For posted workers, it's closer to 40 years old. So those workers are older. And again, this is pretty logical. Maybe those workers have a huge attachment to their origin country. Maybe they have a family. Maybe they have a house. And so for them, it's not really an option to leave everything they have in order to settle a new life in another country. But if their employer wants to find a customer abroad and want to send those workers abroad in order to perform a job, maybe those experienced blue-collar workers are going to be very good in order to move and in order to perform projects.
How big is this European posting policy? In terms of the size of the economic activity being impacted, is this EU policy important?
This posting policy is not only some institutional curiosity, it's actually big if you look at the numbers. Today, or in 2019, there were roughly 2 million workers in terms of full-time equivalent that were engaged in this posting policy. So it's not so big in terms of total employment stock. It's roughly 2% of employment stock in Europe, but it's going to start to be very big if you scale that by employment in the sectors that are using the posting policy. I think another way to understand the magnitude of those flows is actually to compare them to other flows linked to other economic freedom, so trade in goods or trade in services, for instance. And so if you look at the data, the flows that are triggered by those posting contracts represent roughly 2% of GDP. To give you an order of magnitude, this is equivalent to 10% of trade in goods within the EU, so it's not nothing, but it's one third of all trade and services flows in the EU. So in terms of contribution to how much we trade across European countries, it's actually as large or even larger than trade in financial services or technological services, you know, those type of sectors we always obsess over when we want to liberalize trade, like when Brexit happened. And if you look at the numbers, you know, we trade as many Polish plumbers than we trade consultant services or accounting services in the EU.
In trade terms, what are the patterns of these trade flows between EU countries?
In terms of the geography of those flows, what I think is also very striking is that those flows are unbalanced in terms of origin and destination, and they're much more unbalanced than trade in goods, for instance. So posting flows tend to flow mostly from low to high wage countries. So the main sending countries are going to be Eastern European countries and Portugal and Spain. And the main destination countries are going to be almost exclusively rich countries. So roughly 85 to 90% of posting flows actually go to those older member states with higher level of wages. So you have this huge imbalance, which is a bit opposite to what you see for trading goods, because trading goods is pretty balanced actually in the EU, and the countries that trade more goods are actually the richer countries. So France and Germany, for instance, trade a lot of goods between them, but don't trade a lot of posted workers compared to how many France import workers from Poland.
You have assembled all of this amazing data. There are so many economic questions to ask. You start by looking at what happens to local labor markets in France.
This posting policy kind of boomed because the Eastern European member state entered in the EU. There were a lot of heterogeneity in the way different places in France were exposed to the posting policy. Some regions got a lot of posted workers and some regions didn't get a lot. And so that allows you to compare these regions in order to understand what happened in places that got more.
What did you find?
What you see in the data is that the employment of French workers did decrease. The magnitude was not huge. It was a 6% relative decrease, but still it decreased in the heavily exposed sectors. So basically, French workers in construction, manufacturing services, and agriculture mostly were kind of hit in terms of employment in those regions. However, their wages stayed pretty constant. So let's say the French labor market is pretty rigid, so it's very hard to decrease wages for existing workers. So kind of the adjustment worked through the employment margin. So we just hired less French workers and we hired more posted workers in those places.
What else can you tell us about the negative impact of the posting policy on employment in France? Did it result in a lot of unemployment?
One other interesting insight in that effect is that when we think about employment decreasing, we always think about people losing their job and getting unemployed, which is not exactly what happens, because people don't necessarily reallocate from the construction job to, let's say, the waiter job that is sheltered from the posting policy. We didn't see a lot of that happening in France, so we didn't see a lot of sectoral reallocation. The unemployment increased a bit, but not as much as what is implied by the change in local employment, which tend to indicate that probably what happened is that either people retired earlier, so they just left the labor force as this competition was kicking in, or maybe they stayed at the university a bit longer, at school a bit longer.
That's the impact of the EU posting policy on the country that receives the posted workers. France is the importer there. What is the impact on the sending country, the exporter? Let's start with the firms in Portugal sending those workers to a place like France. What happens to the Portuguese firms?
Well, you can see that in the data is pretty striking. Those firms, they are, again, construction firms, very small firms, carpenters. You must think about those firms as really, you know, their average number of employees is 10 people. So those are small firms. They're not the tooled up exporters we usually think about. And so those firms do scale up a lot once they get connected to a foreign customer and they just earn more contracts abroad. So they increase their sales in order to, you know, catch up on this increased demand. They hire more workers in Portugal, they increase their profits. And interestingly, they also kind of substitute what they do in Portugal to what they do abroad. So they start serving less Portuguese customers and they shift most of their activity abroad during the posting assignment.
How big are the gains to the Portuguese firm doing these posting contracts compared to the gains for a traditional exporter of goods? So if you were to compare a firm posting carpenters to a firm exporting wine or a car manufacturer, what would you find?
So if you compare the gains from trade at the micro level in Portugal between the wine manufacturer and the carpenter, in terms of relative expansion, you get the same number. So those two firms gain equally in terms of relative increase in size and in employees. And that was kind of pretty surprising to me, actually, because before starting this, I didn't really know whether I should expect that the small carpenter will have like big gains in terms of growth from trading as opposed to the car manufacturer, which we all know is going to gain a lot from trade.
Those are the posting firms in Portugal, the exporters. What about the workers in Portugal that go off to France to do the work for the firm? How well do they do economically?
So what happened to those workers in Portugal who get sent abroad by their employer is that they get wage gains, and those wage gains are pretty substantial. You should think about a 14 to 15% increase in wages after you get sent abroad. But those wage gains are not as high as the profit gains for employers. And I think what this tells you is that because you are now intermediating those migration flows with firms, this means that you have to redistribute the surplus from integration or from immigration. And the surplus is really this new contract between the Portuguese firm and the French customer. Well, the surplus of that new link has to be split between those three entities, right? What you see in the data is that the Portuguese workers do get something. They don't get all of it, right? So the producer are just capturing part of this, of those gains.
Let's go back again to the issue of the minimum wage and the controversy you told us about that led to the 1996 change that said posted workers have to earn at least the host country's minimum wage. How did you examine whether the minimum wage mattered for worker wages, and what did you find?
And so one big question was always, obviously, do we need the minimum wage regulation in order to ensure that workers get something from the surplus? There were some free market advocates that were saying that, you know, if the labor market is very efficient and competitive, the Portuguese workers should be able to bargain enough with their Portuguese employer so that they just threat them to work for the French firm directly if they don't get some wage gains. And so I try to investigate that. And the way I do it is by comparing the wage gains for workers that are in Portugal. So those workers are sent to high wage countries where the minimum wages are higher than the wage they receive in Portugal. But I also have the same data for Luxembourg. So Luxembourg is small, but does perform a lot of posting services and also in the same sectors as the Portuguese firms. But obviously, Luxembourg is a very high minimum wage. So it's not constrained in a sense by any minimum wages abroad. So by doing this comparison between the wage gain in those different countries, you can have an idea of how much the minimum wage matters for the Portuguese workers. And what I find is that, well, most of the wage gains in Portugal seem to be driven by the minimum wage abroad. So it seems that this regulation that the EU put in place was really key in ensuring that the gains from integration, from migration, was redistributed at least partially to the workers.
Another way this EU posting policy could have a distributional impact between EU member states is through what country gets to collect the tax revenue from worker income. How does the EU posting policy work, and what did you find?
So one big aspect of the posting policy was also its implication for taxation, tax revenues, and so on and so forth. And this is mostly because we don't have a European budget, so borders do matter for taxes and for redistribution. And so obviously, when we usually think about migration, one big issue or worry we have is about this, what we call brain drain, right? So you have migrants leaving Portugal, they go to France, so they stop paying taxes in Portugal. Maybe they were having some productivity gains that was generating some economic activity in Portugal. They leave, Portugal lose those guys, but France is on the other end winning some new workers, we're going to pay their taxes, we're going to contribute to the French economy, and so on and so forth. What the posting policy did was to really reverse, to switch this fiscal externality and to make, in a sense, migration the same than trade. So when a Portuguese firm sells more cars abroad, it's very good for Portugal because Portugal is taxing more employment, more profit, and so on and so forth. And that's the reason why probably countries want to win market shares abroad. Now you see that when all of a sudden a construction firm in Portugal is sending more people from Portugal to France, what happens is more social security contributions and more tax payment for Portugal, and nothing changes for France, except if there are some French workers who are losing their jobs and not paying taxes anymore. So the fiscal externality is really reversed here. And so what I document in the paper is that this policy was very good for the tax revenues in the sending countries, but not so much in the receiving countries.
Those are the basics of the EU posting policy. You have this incredible new research documenting its size, who benefits from it, who's hurt by it, and by how much. Now I want to go back to the mid-2000s, just after European enlargement, that added all of these new member states in Eastern Europe. Tell us about the policy proposal to change the EU posting policy and the controversy that resulted from that proposal.
So what happened is that just after enlargement, you know, Eastern European countries were very happy to be part of the EU, but they were very unhappy about something. They were very unhappy about the idea that the construction firm had to pay the minimum wage abroad when exporting services, while their neighbor, let's say the car manufacturer, didn't have to worry about what's the French minimum wage when it was selling, you know, the cars to French customers. And so the Polish commissioner, Bolkenstein, had this idea that free trade can only exist or be guaranteed in the European Union if we get rid of this minimum wage requirement in the posting policy. So in 2005, he introduced this infamous Bolkenstein directive at the European Parliament. And this created the first instance of coordinated strikes and protests in Western European Union. So basically what happened is that many people got very worried, in particular in France, in Belgium, in Netherlands, so in countries with very high standards, they got very worried that they will have to compete very soon with workers that were not subject to the same minimum wage than themselves, right? And so we had this huge wave of protests in all European capital. It was so big that the French president had to go to Brussels to call for the withdrawal of the Bolkenstein directive.
Why was the French president so worried about the Bolkestein directive?
It was because France was actually at the same time voting for the European Constitution. So there were the Lisbon Treaty that was supposed to be the last step of the European integration and was supposed to enforce a new European Constitution. And some countries like France chose to put that project to the ballot and to have a referendum. And it was a simple referendum. Are you for or against? So yes, it's for European integration, no, it's against. And what you see in the numbers is that the day the Bolkenstein directive was introduced at the European Parliament and everyone starts to worry about the Polish plumber polemic, the support for European integration among French voters dropped dramatically. It went from 60 to less than 50, basically, and remained low until the end. And as of today, we still believe that the reason why France rejected the European Treaty and the European Constitution was because there were a proposal to remove the minimum wage requirement for posted workers. After the failure of this referendum, what happened is that the Bolkenstein directive was withdrawn. So there were no mention anymore of this principle that were supposed to remove the minimum wage requirement. And France ultimately passed this European constitution by the parliament to just avoid the voters.
The Bolkestein directive is pulled, so it's not part of EU posting policy after all. But it creates such a big uproar in France that France sends the vote for the European constitution through parliament to avoid its voters in a referendum. Amazing. What do you think we can learn from that French voter backlash?
What this tells us, I think, is that voters do care a lot about what is driving trade. And if they perceive that European integration or trade flows are just based on differences in institutions, so differences in the choice that French voters make for their minimum wage as opposed to the choice that Portugal makes, then they don't want to be in a unified market anymore. And I think this was the first time where France actually rejected a European, you know, treaty. And that's a big deal for a founding member of the EU. And as of today, we're still trying to recover from that big backlash that generated a persistent cleavages among French voters.
On that question, do labor regulations like minimum wages impact trade across European countries? What's the evidence? What do we know so far about this really important question?
On the topic of whether trade is driven by those differences in minimum wages across European countries, or we don't know, and we don't know why it always has been a very important for policymakers and trade economists, right? If you think about the debates around child labor and labor standards in the 90s, for many countries in the world, it always has been a very important and pressing question on whether trade is also a way for countries to exploit in a way those differences in standards and labor market regulations. But this is very hard to study because you need very good data on workers' standards of working and on their wages and so on and so forth, and that's hard to do.
It is hard to do, but you are going to try to examine the impact of labor market regulations, like minimum wage laws, on international trade. How do you use the posting policy to do this?
What is very interesting about the posting data is that this allows you to track literal export of workers and their labor institutions, because you can know what is exactly the minimum wage or the payroll taxes they're subject to. What I do is that I use this data on posted workers' flows in order to identify how those flows change when some countries decided to change their labor market regulations. So, for example, one very interesting experiment that we had in the EU was the implementation introduction of a minimum wage in Germany. So what happened before 2015 is that Germany didn't have national minimum wage. So they had minimum wages that were agreed at the firm level or the branch level. And so what this meant is that foreign firms engaging in posting were not legally binded by this minimum wage. So the German workers had to be paid at the firm level minimum wage, but the Polish posted workers sent by the Polish firm didn't have to comply with any other regulation than the Polish minimum wage. So before 2015, what we know from some numbers and statistics from labor unions was that the average wage of, let's say, a posted worker in the meat processing industry in Germany was around €3 per hour, while it was €16 per hour for German workers in the same industry. And so as a result, 50% of workers in the meat processing industry in Germany before 2015 were actually sent by foreign suppliers of services.
What happened?
Well, this situation led to an entire big political dispute, right? So Belgium and France filed a trade complaint against Germany to say that Germany was gaining unfair competitive advantage in trade in meat because of this weird minimum wage arbitrage that German firms were engaging in doing. So Germany has to face this political controversy. So in 2015, Germany decides to introduce a German minimum wage that is binding for everyone, including the foreign suppliers of services. And so what you can do is to see what happens after 2015 to firms that had to match the new German minimum wage compared to firms that didn't have to match this minimum wage.
you are establishing a control group of firms there. Who are the firms that didn't have to match the new German minimum wage?
Those are the firms operating in the construction industry, because construction was the only sector in Germany before 2015 that was allowed to have a sectoral minimum wage that applied to foreign firms. So you have this very neat experiment where you can say, okay, what happened to the competitiveness of the Polish firm when they, you know, must move from the 3 euros to the 8 euro new minimum wage?
Because of an intra-European trade dispute over the meat processing industry brought by Belgium and France, Germany has to impose a minimum wage for all sectors of its economy. And it has to impose it on the foreign firms, like these Polish firms that had been sending posted workers under the EU posting policy who only earned 3 euros per hour. Their wage suddenly has to go up to 8 euros per hour. Overall, what do you find?
What you see there is that imports of services in exposed industries in Germany after 2015 completely decreased, right? They were almost cut by half and as of today are almost non-existent. So this tells you that really the bulk of the comparative advantage that those foreign firms had when supplying services to Germany was coming from this weird thing that they were subject to different minimum wage as opposed to other firms, even though the services were, you know, supplied in the same country, in the same region, sometimes in the same factory, using the same capital, the same infrastructure, but you just had these weird differences in regulations.
Amazing. Minimum wages, or the lack of minimum wages here, I guess, clearly mattered for these trade flows. So the French referendum voters might have been a little bit right if what they were saying was differences in labor market regulations across countries can affect economic activity. Taking a step back, what are some of the limitations to your results?
So one first limitation that comes to mind is that the effects I'm estimating on those domestic workers, for instance, in the French labor market, are all in relative terms. That means I'm comparing workers in places that got more posted workers compared to places that get less. And that means that this is not the end of the story. That doesn't tell you that GDP decreased or that overall welfare decreased. It just tells you that there were some people that were more affected than others, accounting for aggregate trends in the economy. Another important aspect of this, I think, and that's always something we have in the back of our mind when we think about trade policy, is the effect on potential efficiency, prices, customers, right? And the only reason why the European Union is also trying to build this unified market and to have this freedom to supply services is because we think competition is very good for customers. So we think that the French customers are going to benefit from houses built at lower prices. Maybe the infrastructures are going to be better, and this is going to generate additional economic gains that are going to be redistributed and are going to benefit everyone in the end. And I think one issue with these approaches I've just described that use micro data and are trying to measure things, that is very hard to get to those aggregate efficiency price effects. So I'm not sure I can tell you right now whether customers really got decreases in prices, whether we had this kind of positive loop that was generated by the liberalization of the policies.
Mathilde, as my last question, if you wanted to leave policymakers with one big takeaway from your research, what would it be?
The main overall takeaway is that economic integration is tough and you need to be very creative in terms of policy and intervention to foster it. And the posting policy was in the end a very good example of that. It was a policy that really managed to connect some firms and some workers with each other. And we saw that it really contributed to the entire integration of the market. But this also had important distributional consequences because economic integration also comes at the expenses of some relocation in the labor market, some more competition. And if we come back to the initial motivation that was about, oh, do we build a United States of Europe? We do need more integration and we probably do need more policies that foster migration and that foster trade. But we also need the political support. We also need the voters to say yes when we ask them, do you want more Europe? And in a way, I think one main lesson I take away from my research on the posting policy is that it seems very hard to think about trade liberalization without thinking about the question of social convergence and institutions and redistribution.
Mathilde, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And that is all for Trade Talks. A huge thanks to Mathilde Munoz at the University of California, Berkeley. Do check out Mathilde's paper titled Trading Non-Tradables: The Implications of Europe's Job Posting Policy. It will soon be published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics. Mathilde has a hot off the presses second paper I recommend as well, titled International Trade Responses to Labor Market Regulations. I will post a link to both papers on the episode page of the Trade Talks website. Thanks to Melina Kalb, our supervising producer. Thanks to Sarah Toot on digital. As always, thanks to Colin Warren, our audio guy. Do follow us on Twitter or X. We're on @trade_talks. That's not one but two underscores, @trade_talks. Because when it comes to papers about the EU's posting policy, two are better than one.